Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Catherine Kraft, who's curator at the Nasher Sculpture Center and a scholar of modern art movements, including Dada, Surrealism, Abstract Expressionism, and Neo-Dada. She recently curated The Nature of Art at the Nasher, which will open at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April, as well as the touring exhibition Melvin Edwards' Five Decades in 2015. As well as the accompanying catalogs for both shows. She's also the author of the books An Audience of Artists, Dada, Neo-Dada, and the Emergence of Abstract Expressionism, published by University of Chicago Press, and Robert Rauschenberg, published by Phaidon Press. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come and talk with you.
Well, I wanted to start by asking about ARP, and in particular, his interest in this idea of nature, where he's not interested in the illusionistic substitutes for nature, i.e. landscape painting or representing nature, but it seems that he sort of sees nature as a kind of force within the work of art, the kind of generation, production, metamorphosis, this sort of thing. And he it sounds like he sees his works of art as kind of natural objects in a way. And so I wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little about kind of maybe where he got this idea of nature and how it plays out in his work?
During World War I, ARP was horrified by the violence and carnage that was really tearing apart the very place that he grew up and the cultures in which he grew up. And looking for an alternative, nature seemed an alternative to him that would be a great antidote for the sort of foolishness and arrogance of humanity that had led them into this mess, so to speak. ARP had already become very interested in abstract art before the war. He didn't want to imitate the appearance of nature, because imitating the appearance of nature, that's one thing that really the legacy of Western art had been teaching artists how to do. And that was part of the system that seemed so flawed and kind of no longer helpful in the world he found himself living. And I think the idea of looking to nature, not so much the way it appeared, but the way it worked, its operations and principles, looking kind of below the surface of appearances, is something that he became very interested in. And during the war, these years of the 19-teens, he found various ways of expressing a connection to nature by the way in which he worked. Sometimes these were kind of principles that you'd see in nature, such as bilateral symmetry. But I think one of the things that really happened to him that he constantly went back to as a point of reference was a walk that he took, or maybe a series of walks, along the shores of a lake outside of Zurich, Switzerland. And he saw all kinds of flotsam and jetsam kind of cast up from on the shore, and he started making sketches from them, and sort of sketches out of those sketches, and developing really this whole kind of types of forms that were really inspired by the sort of random action of waves upon the shore. And it was out of these sort of forms that I think were really formed out of these forms that came out of the liquidity of the ink as much as what he's actually seeing, really kind of led him into this whole new language of a formal language that was both abstract and yet still seemed to suggest elements of the natural world.
I know that when I've learned a bit about ARP previously, people use this term biomorphic, not only about ARP, but other artists. And sometimes that term is used, you know, for, I guess, for anything that looks vaguely natural. But in the case of ARP, I mean, you just referred to the waves on the shore and things like this, this sense of like dynamism, energy, metamorphosis, change. It seems like that's a it's not just about the form, but about the kind of energy or something like that. And that was part of his work for a while too, right?
I think that's a really important I think that's a really important aspect of the work, really pretty much throughout his life, looking at trying to find an art that could change on its own or could surprise him as much as it might surprise a spectator.
Yeah.
Art that seemed to have a sort of natural sense of progression. It's hard not to use the word nature or natural when talking about it, but it's not very helpful, I think. But I think one of the things that ARP was looking for was a way to make art that also didn't just depend upon himself as a sort of great romantic artist.
Right, right.
Nature was also an alternative that offered a sense of humility that he felt really needed to be restored to the identity of the artist.
Yeah.
At the same time, even though we really associate all these sort of fluid, natural forms with his work, there are other aspects of nature that kind of cut against that a little bit. He had a great interest in fragmentation, for example,
right.
in cutting and breaking things apart, and by association with entropy, the way that systems run down or leaving things to chance,
right.
which is another way of sort of taking the creative process out of an artist's hands.
When you mentioned his interest in violence or fragmentation, cutting, and so on and so forth, it sounds like he sees that as a part of nature, essentially, more than it's not just about, say, the war or human violence. Although I assume that's important, it's more this broader, deeper, natural thing. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a text that was published around 1920 that Arp wrote with two friends of his, and it's about the sort of art that he was hoping to make. And he described wanting to make an art that was as natural as a bud bursting open or a flower reproducing or a stone breaking away from a cliff.
Yeah.
And that kind of image, which, you know, it's an image of, we might think of it as violent, but it's not necessarily connected to death, because presumably a rock isn't going to feel pain when it splits off from a cliff. But I think he saw that as very much a part of things. At the same time, if somebody close to him passed away or was sick, he felt that very deeply. It doesn't necessarily mean that he accepted it fully within his own life.
Right. Speaking of kind of the his relationships and so forth, obviously the maybe central, or I assume maybe most important relationship with the artist, Sophie Teuber, who he married and was Sophie Teuber Arp, who I know especially worked in textiles and collage. Could you just tell us a little bit about their collaboration or kind of their artistic relationship with one another, with each other?
That's a fascinating topic.
I'm sure it's a whole book on that topic.
Well, there are several books and there are several museum exhibitions devoted to it. Sophie Teuber Arp is a wonderful artist in her own right. And one of the happy developments during the time I was preparing for this show was learning that there's going to be a retrospective of her work coming up in 2020, I believe. And so it in some ways sort of relieved me of the responsibility of needing to focus too much attention on her, because it's great to consider them together, but I think it's also very helpful to try to tease them apart and consider them separately. One of the interesting things in working on ARP himself is that he is in some ways responsible for how closely we think about them in context with each other. They met in 1915 at an opening of his work in a group show, and he was already making sort of textiles, needlework and tapestries. And she had recently graduated from studying this particular type of work They became friends. They probably at some point during the teens or early 20s also began collaborating on works of art, collages and needlework particularly. She also would sometimes execute his designs for needleworks because she had technically just a much greater skill than he did. And some of which has also led it to sometimes being difficult to tease out who did what in these bodies of work. Then after they got married, they were, well, let me think. So they got married in 1922. And really her career for a while, she was still teaching in Zurich and was supporting both of them really when he couldn't always sell work. They received in the mid 20s a commission for the decor of this entertainment complex in Strasbourg, which was ARP's hometown. And it included designs for a movie theater, a cafe, a sort of dance hall. And the money they made from that project allowed them to buy a plot of land outside Paris, build a house that she designed, and it let her quit her job. And so it's really from the late 20s onward that she's able to really start asserting a much more independent identity as an artist. And so she is making reliefs as well as continuing to make some textile designs and collages. In the late 30s in particular, she and ARP collaborate on works together. Mm-hmm. That's that sort of group of works is one thing that we focused on in the exhibition. But all along, I mean, all along, ARP was supportive of her becoming a fine artist, but at the same time, she was still expected, and she also took it upon herself to run their household and entertain. I think they had quite regularly on Sundays, they would have people over for dinners and discussions, and that all kind of just was expected she would be doing that. And that was, I think she enjoyed it, but it was also very frustrating to not have enough, feel like she had enough time for all this.
Yes.
When World War II started, the two of them fled to the south of France. They were hoping to go to New York. They couldn't get the paperwork figured out, or they couldn't get the visas to line up. It was very complicated to try to get out. And they ended up going over into Switzerland since they both had connections there. And it was in 1943 in Switzerland, they were staying with friends, and she went to bed early, and she was sleeping in a room with a heater that apparently malfunctioned, and she died of carbon monoxide poisoning, which just absolutely, as you can imagine, devastated ARP. And it was really one of the singular blows of his life. And the ways he dealt with it, though, were very fascinating, one of which was he did organize a catalogue raisonné of her work. That's what he spent a lot of the 1940s doing. And he also began trying to give her a level of attention that she had not really received during her life. And so all of these wonderful reminiscences that are still a real important source of information about what it was like to be in the Dada movement and what it was like in Zurich in the 19-teens. He wrote almost all of those after her death. And that's also the years of their kind of early courtship. And so in many cases, he really emphasized the collaborative works they did together and the collaborative nature of their partnership. And there's not always corroborating contemporary evidence. And so one of the challenges for anybody working on both these artists is to respect that this was a real and I think substantial and rewarding partnership for both artists. But there was a lot of myth making that occurred at a point where she couldn't speak up about it. I mean, it was no longer her voice being involved. So I don't know if that quite answers your question. Well, it's a really complicated relationship.
it's so fascinating. And then I think you mentioned in the catalog that her death, the effect that it had on him in his art, in his kind of reflection or coming to terms in the art that he was making. Could you talk a little bit about that, like after her death in 1943?
Well, it took a couple of different directions. One direction was an interest in one effect. One place where you see an effect in Arp's work is the ways in which he found to carry on this collaboration.
Right.
And in fact, it was something that seemed to me an interesting enough and complicated enough topic that I asked one of the scholars that I asked to write for the catalog, Valburga Krupp, who is also going to be working on the Teuber Arp retrospective. I asked her to write about this idea of posthumous collaboration.
Right.
There are a number of works that I think have been credited to Teuber Arp or have been kind of in this gray area where people didn't quite know what to do with them, where Arp took drawings or designs that she had made and had them executed as reliefs, for example, or as tapestries. And they weren't necessarily things that, you know, we don't know that she would have wanted to do that.
Right.
He was acting on a presumption that he thought that's what something she would have been interested in.
Right.
But it was also clear, and it was something I think, it was something he thought he could do for her.
Right.
But it was also a way of continuing this creative partnership, taking something she had created and rendering it in another format.
Yeah.
Which is, in fact, how he himself worked as an artist with his own reliefs, for example. He would take designs and have carpenters cut out the forms, and he would join them together, or in his later years, he had other people join them together. Another effect that definitely came after World War II is there's a much greater interest in spirituality,
right,
his work in the last two decades of his life. There's definitely an increased interest in the world beyond, and not surprisingly, a consistent despair or contempt for humanity's brutality.
Yeah.
Which, even without her death, I mean, having gone through two world wars,
And
then there are also specific places where you can see him perhaps borrowing or being inspired by motifs in her work.
Yeah.
And using it in his own work.
Yeah. On the general question of kind of interpreting the past and also interpreting Arp's interpretations of the past and the kind of layers of understanding there, I wanted to also ask you about the idea of chance, where if I understand correctly, around 1930, when the Surrealists were very interested in chance from the Surrealist perspective, they were also interested in what Arp had done earlier with chance, but their interest and his weren't necessarily the same, and the way he was remembering and recalling what he'd done some years earlier was sort of a complicated situation. So I just wondered if you could talk about how you untangle all of those different aspects of it.
Certainly. I don't know that I've untangled them,
yeah.
Or at least I can point to where the tangles are. that was a particularly fascinating question for me, because Arp's data collages, which often are accompanied by such titles as Arranged According to the Laws of Chance,
right,
were terrifically influential on later generations of artists. Ellsworth Kelly, for example, visited Arp in his studio outside Paris and was very taken with these chance collages and made chance collages of his own. The collages that Arp made during the Dada period that get these sort of chance titles attached to them. Some of them were exhibited during that period, but there's no record of them being exhibited with titles or with any text or information that relates them to chance process.
Right, right.
At the same time, you can say that nobody else was really making collages that looked like this, that had this sort of geometric grid that was tossed askew.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of reached the conclusion that it's altogether possible that ARP was experimenting with these kinds of chance processes.
Yeah.
But I tend to believe that he hadn't theorized it
right
at that point. I don't believe there were laws of chance
right
at that point myself.
Interesting.
And it was never so regularized as that kind of a process. I think for ARP, chance really meant moving things around in kind of an improvised way.
Yeah.
And again, finding a way to kind of short circuit his own ego, his own expectations.
Yeah.
And I think, like almost every other modern artist, almost every other artist I've known, he was concerned about getting credit for things that he had done early on when there may not have been the same kind of audience that there was in Paris and the Surrealists at that point in the late 1920s.
Something about that makes me think of Duchamp and his own efforts to, well, I guess probably many, many artists do this, but it just seems like in the case of work that's maybe especially cerebral or ephemeral or complicated or avant-garde, you know, something mm-hmm. that takes a lot of effort to kind of take care of, that it seems like Duchamp was someone else who put a lot of effort into trying to make sure that what he'd done was cataloged and, you know, presented mm-hmm. and remembered. But anyway, that's just what came to mind. But.
Well, I think, I've also done work on Duchamp, and I thought of him regularly while I was working on ARP. There, it's rather different cases because I think ARP was sort of a more object-based artist in some ways than Duchamp, but that is, I think ARP made works that are easier to sort of categorize as sculpture. Yeah. Even though the relief sculptures are really meant, I think, to confuse our distinctions between paintings and sculptures.
Yeah.
But one thing that I think needs to be better understood about ARP's work, and I think Duchamp is a useful point of reference in that regard, is that I think ARP was not so terribly interested in the original object.
Mm-hmm.
He seems, one source of some confusion in studies of ARP's work is the fact that he tended to feel comfortable remaking and refabricating things.
Yeah.
Which, if you're thinking about, say, a relief as a painting, which is supposed to be this unique object that has a certain value, that can be very worrying.
Right.
But my tendency is to think that ARP thought of it as being much closer to the way Duchamp thought of his ready-mades.
Yeah, yeah.
That they would, that it was the concept of them that was the most important thing, and you could execute them in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think ARP was especially interested in seeing them. I think ARP was especially interested in seeing variations on his ideas. Yeah. I feel like Duchamp was open to variation when he produced replicas of ready-mades.
Right.
But I think for ARP, part of the fun almost was editing and tinkering and messing around with it. And yet that it still had a kernel of the same idea that inspired it.
Yeah. Well, as I wanted to also ask you about your book on Dada, Neo-Dada, and Abstract Expressionism in New York, and I thought as a kind of transition, I would ask you about ARP's reception in New York, and especially after after World War II and this in this whole context of the rise of New York and all of this. Can you say a little bit about how his work was received in this country? And...
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it speaks, I think, to not just the importance of Arp's work overall, which I think we've lost sight of a little bit today, how historically significant it was for a large number of artists, but also the fact that Arp's importance kind of came in waves,
right,
depending on what work was being shown.
Yeah.
So, for example, with the abstract expressionists, artists like de Kooning or Gorky or Pollock, the works that I think was really important for them to see were Arp's Dada reliefs and his reliefs of the 20s, which were shown in New York in the 1930s and at Art of the Century at Peggy Guggenheim's gallery in the early 40s. And that kind of amoeboid, what you were referring to as biomorphic, this form that seems to be abstract and yet still suggest a form, you see that all over the place.
Was that what was the ARP shape? ARP, was that the term?
Yes, it's what Alfred, that's what Alfred H. Barr called the ARP shape that pops up in many, many works of that period. And in fact, was so influential that it kind of obscured, I think, later on, the fact that this came from ARP ultimately.
Right.
That was one wave. And another aspect of interest was ARP's work in collage, which was particularly important for Robert Motherwell. And what interested Motherwell, the collages that most interested Motherwell, interestingly, were the collages that ARP started making around 1930, around this time of revival of interest among the surrealists in chants and also in collage itself. ARP apparently, again, according to the story that he told, he found a group of his early collages that had started to deteriorate, and he tore them up and made collages from them. And this tearing of paper, the papier déchiré, became really, on the one hand, a technique that ARP used to make work for the rest of his life.
Right.
And then in turn, that work, when it was seen in New York in the 40s, was enormously important to Robert Motherwell.
Right.
And his practice of collage bears a fairly large debt to ARP's example. So that's kind of one aspect of ARP's impact on American artists. I spoke already of Ellsworth Kelly a bit. And I think, you know, the other thing that Kelly liked about ARP's work, and that speaks also to his impact on the next generation of American artists, I think Kelly was also looking for a way of making art that wasn't self-expressive.
Right.
And ARP's connecting of his work to nature, one of the things that he wrote about and he said in various contexts, is that he described, you know, the fact that you can have a field of flowers and they can all be the same species. So they're all the same, but they're all different.
Right.
And I think that kind of concept of repetition and variation is something that was very appealing to Kelly also. He's in relation to ARP's work, he has said something similar.
Yeah.
And in him, he found a way to use nature in his work that, again, was not about resemblance.
Right.
Interestingly, after World War II, the works by ARP that began to be shown more frequently were his sculptures in the round.
Right.
And those works tended to be so highly finished to New York eyes. You know, ARP's reliefs always have kind of smooth edges and they're very cleanly painted, but there's always something kind of clunky and awkward and a little chunky about them.
Yeah.
The sculptures looked like they hadn't been touched by anybody.
Yeah.
And the abstract expressionists really did not like that.
De
Kooning made this comment that he preferred, you know, De Kooning preferred the shoes of Van Gogh to the pebbles of Arp.
Oh.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it took an artist like Donald Judd,
yeah,
looking at Arp's work to see something, to see the value in, to look at Arp's sculpture and see why he was working that way.
Right.
When Judd was writing reviews in the early 60s, he reviewed a show at the Sydney Janus Gallery, and he talked about how the smooth finish of Arp's works allows you to see works, it allows you to see the sculptures as a whole.
Yeah.
And that you have to have this kind of blandness and smoothness to be able to kind of almost have this gestalt experience of the singular form.
Right.
And that, of course, was very encouraging to Judd, who was just then also trying to develop a similar effect in his own work.
Huh. This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and our guest today is Catherine Kraft. When we come back, we'll talk more about the sculptor Melvin Edwards, whose work was featured in the retrospective Melvin Edwards, 5 Decades at the Nasher Sculpture Center.